Hello and welcome to Science World. Roseanne Skirbel tells us that scientists from Northern Illinois University are reviewing their data to look for clues that could explain why the ice in Antarctica is melting so quickly and how it impacts sea level. Speaking of sea level, Bob Doty's in to report on researchers who have found that sea level in New York and other points along the East Coast spiked over a two-year period. And researchers at Columbia and Harvard universities are working on a unique new way to treat atherosclerosis, or hardening of the arteries, that can lead to a heart attack or stroke. We'll talk with one of the leaders of the research team to learn more about this new treatment method. We'll have these stories and more on today's edition of VOA Science, Health and Technology Magazine, Science World. Back from their three-month expedition to Antarctica's Ross Ice Shelf, scientists from Northern Illinois University are now going through their data. They hope to find clues that explain the dynamics of the rapidly melting ice and its impact on sea level. Roseanne Skirbel has the story.
Antarctica is the driest, coldest, and windiest place on the planet. Northern Illinois University professors Ross Powell and Reed Scherer just wrapped up their second National Science Foundation-sponsored expedition there.
The central focus of the research was to try and get some actual physical constraints on what the ice sheet looks like over time and what it's doing right now.
And so we chose a study site where in the first year we went into the subglacial lake and tried to understand the environment in there, both ecologically and in terms of the ice dynamics, about how the lake operates and how the sediment underneath the ice sheet operates as well, because it's the water and the sediment underneath the ice that controls how fast the ice is flowing into the ocean.
Powell led the expedition that included a team of scientists, engineers, mechanics, and technicians. Tractors pulled their electric generators, science labs, heavy machinery, and other gear 1,000 kilometers from the McMurdo Station and set up camp downstream from the subglacial lake of the previous study. This season, they worked in an area called the grounding zone, where Antarctic ice, land, and sea converge.
What we have found is that these are very sensitive areas to the stability of how dynamic the ice is and how fast the ice may react to increases in melting both from the ocean and the atmosphere.
Among the new instruments built for the expedition was a powerful hot water drill, which was used to bore down some 740 meters. There, the team was the first to collect water and sediment samples from the grounding zone. Working around the clock before the deep hole refroze, they sent a remote camera down to the 400-square-meter marine cavity. Scherer says what appeared on the video monitors in the command center was a total surprise.
It's a very mobile environment. The bottom is changing constantly. And so the things that we saw are all very mobile organisms, things that swim and some things that crawl. And obviously they're getting enough nutrition that they can thrive. Some of the little crustacean-like creatures called amphipods that we saw swam quite quickly and were quite active.
This is the farthest south that fish have ever been seen. How did the creatures get there? What do they feed on? And what impact will the retreating ice have on them? Powell says the ice and sediment cores taken from the grounding zone can offer clues.
We know that the ice is melting there at the moment, and so by opening up the cores once they get back, we hope to be able to understand what the ice was doing in the past relative to what it is doing now. And because it's melting so fast, or seems to be melting fast at the moment, we anticipate that there'll be some differences that we'll see in the history of the ice sheet from the sediment cores once we open them up.
Powell says the work raises more questions than it answers. Together with other researchers, he's planning to apply for another grant to return to the frozen continent. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
A lot of scrap metal winds up in landfills instead of being recovered and recycled. One of the main reasons for this is the difficulty of large-scale separation of non-ferrous metals such as aluminum and copper. Scientists at the University of Utah now say they have solved that problem. George Putich tells us more.
Recycling metals is much cheaper than extracting them from the ore, but chopping up old cars, appliances, or industrial equipment results in a mixture of different metal parts. Iron and steel are easily separated with strong magnets, while others, such as copper, aluminum, and titanium, either end up in landfills or are shipped to countries with cheap labor to pick out the different metal by hand. Researchers at the University of Utah now say they have developed a method for mechanically separating light metals with high degree of accuracy. Don Eggert of O2M Technologies, which partnered with the school in developing the technology, says the system is based on the fact that all metals react to a strong magnetic field.
When the metal falls through the field, even though it's non-ferrous, it's not attracted to the magnet, but the magnet causes there to be an electric current inside of the metal, and that causes the metal to have a magnetic field itself, which interacts with the magnetic field it's falling through and pushes it to the side.
Eggert says rapid change in the frequency of the magnetic field results in metal pieces falling into different bins.
So, for example, if we want to separate aluminum and copper, we hit the right frequency for it, and the aluminum will push more away from the magnet than the copper will. So the copper falls straight down, the aluminum falls into a different bucket.
This is just one of the technologies for separating different metals, but Eggert says it is much cheaper to build since it requires only one large circular magnet and a frequency controller.
What we've calculated so far is that the expense to value ratio, that is, how quickly you can pay back the cost of the technology over time, we're currently estimating it to be less than 1 year.
At the moment, the separator works only with pellets up to 1 centimeter wide. Researchers are now building a bigger magnet with a wider cut to accommodate larger metal parts. They hope to have it installed at the metal shredding facility sometime this year, where they will be able to test it in a real-life environment. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
This past week, a team of researchers said that the sea level along parts of the eastern U.S. coastline have gone up over a 2-year period. Science World's Bob Doty has the story.
A new study from researchers at the University of Arizona and NOAA has suggested that changes in ocean circulation and climate have caused sea levels from New York to Newfoundland to spike 10 centimeters between 2009 and 2010. Some of this sea level rise stretched as far south as Cape Hatteras, North Carolina. This new study, according to the research team, was the first to show that the changes in ocean circulation were responsible for the unusual increase in sea level. The researchers used various computer climate models to make their findings and to project the likelihood of future jumps in sea level. The team linked the rise in sea level to a change in the ocean's Atlantic meridional overturning circulation and also a change in part of the climate system known as the North Atlantic Oscillation. If the atmospheric carbon dioxide continues to rise at its current level, the researchers said that events such as increases in sea level are likely to occur more frequently. The study outlining the research and findings has been published online in the journal Nature Communications. For Science World, I'm Bob Doty.
It's time for the Science World Quick Quiz. NASA's Dawn spacecraft is approaching the dwarf planet Ceres in the asteroid belt. Scientists continue to be baffled by two bright spots that seem to shine from Ceres' surface. They hope to identify the source of these bright lights once Dawn reaches Ceres in March. For today's Science World Quick Quiz, according to the International Astronomical Union, how many dwarf planets are officially in our solar system? A. 14, B. 98, or C. 5? Think about it. We'll have the correct answer in a few minutes from now.
You're listening to Science World on VOA. You can also find us on the internet, voanews.com/science.
science world is saddened to learn that actor Leonard Nimoy, who became famous for his role as the half-human, half-Vulcan Mr. Spock in the acclaimed science fiction television show and films Star Trek, died at his Los Angeles home on Friday at age 83. Born in Boston on March 26, 1931, Nimoy made his way to Hollywood when he was 18. There he won a few small parts in various 1950s television series. But in 1966, he was cast in his most famous and remembered role as the always logical science officer, Mr. Spock, in the television and movie series Star Trek. Along with acting, Nimoy was also a talented director. Among the films he directed were two of the Star Trek films, as well as the 1987 box office comedy hit Three Men and a Baby. A new licensing agreement with the pharmaceutical company Merck allows for the manufacture of a generic version of a pediatric AIDS drug, but it may be 2 years before it's readily available in low- and middle-income countries. Joe DiCapua reports.
It's estimated there are more than 3 million children living with HIV, but less than a third of them received antiretroviral therapy in 2013. The UN-backed medicines patent pool estimates 700 children are newly infected each day, while 500 die of AIDS-related causes. The Merck drug, raltegravir, has been approved for children as young as 4 weeks. Medicines Patent Pool Executive Director Greg Perry says pediatric AIDS drugs are a neglected area of health care. As a result, many kids with HIV are forced to take adult formulations of antiretroviral pills, or ARVs.
They will taste incorrect. They will have high alcohol content. They will be too big. The children won't take them. So there's a whole series of problems with using adult formulations. And finally, worst of all, of course, is that when you try and break them down, they're not really perfectly digestible to the children or working properly into the bloodstream.
He explains what the licensing agreement with Merck will do.
It does allow really two things. It allows the generic companies to develop and then manufacture low-cost versions of raltegravir. It also enables them to make improvements upon the products and indeed to use them in combination with other products, which is important because we want to see new fixed-dose combinations of pediatric formulations because that's a clear need in the pediatric field.
Currently, the drug is considered a third line of defense, but Perry says there are discussions about using it as a first or second line drug.
It's an important alternative to current sort of preferred product, which is called lopinavir ritonavir. So from a public health point of view, it's an important product.
Perry says it's important to have a wide variety of ARVs in the event HIV builds up resistance to current treatment. He says the Pediatric HIV Treatment Initiative aims to develop new fixed-dose drug combinations. The goal is to have up to 6 new formulations over the next 3 years. U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator Dr. Deborah Burke says, without antiretroviral therapy, 50% of infants with HIV die by age 2 and 80% by age 5. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Scientists at the University of California, Berkeley, have developed a backpack-mounted device that will allow architects, engineers, and building managers to quickly collect data about building interiors. George Putich returns with this report.
Let's say an older building needs a new, more efficient heating and cooling system. The first thing you need is a precise configuration of all rooms, the size and position of heating and cooling elements, windows and doors, electrical outlets. Instead of sending a team of technicians with laser pointers and laptop computers, it will soon be possible to hire only one with a space-age backpack loaded with sophisticated instruments, says engineer Annie Marston, who evaluated the new device.
The backpack is something you can wear which has a lot of sensors on the back, which can then walk through a building and detect the geometry, the lights, the plug load. And once you take it out, you can create a 3D model, which can show an IR image of each of the walls and look at the thermal capacity of the building. And then it can be transferred into an energy model, and that energy model can be run and look at how the energy is dispersed within the building, and that's where we can start looking at saving measures and things like that.
Called Point Cloud Map has accuracy of plus or minus 10 centimeters, to which an algorithm can add surfaces to the walls, floors, and ceilings, turning it into a feature-rich map. This can be used for energy simulation, thermal modeling, and architectural design. Marston says the device may be very useful not only to energy auditors and engineers, but also to the construction industry.
When they're building new construction, it would be great to have a model of the ducts and the pipes before the walls are closed up, so in later years you know where everything is.
Researchers say they are now trying to lower the backpack's weight from 15 to about 10 kilograms. The projected price of about $20,000 is still high, but they predict the device will be available for loan at a more affordable sum. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
Let's see if you have the correct answer to this week's Science World Quick Quiz. According to the International Astronomical Union, how many dwarf planets are officially in our solar system? A, 14, B, 98, or C, 5? The answer is C. The IAU currently lists 5 objects that have been accepted as dwarf planets. They are Pluto, Eris, Makemake, Haumea, and Ceres. It's thought that there may be many, many more out in the solar system. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
You're listening to Science World on VOA. You can also find us on the internet. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
Researchers at Columbia and Harvard universities are working on a futuristic way to treat atherosclerosis, or hardening of the arteries, a condition that could lead to heart attack or stroke. The treatment method uses magnetic and biodegradable nano-sized drones that can find and transport a special type of healing molecule to artery-hardening fat deposits. Dr. Ira Tabus, MD, a researcher and professor of medicine, pathology, and cell biology at New York's Columbia University, is one of the leaders of the research team. He joins us today for our one-on-one segment to talk about the research that led to this new treatment method and how it could help prevent heart attacks and strokes among those who suffer from atherosclerosis. Dr. Tabus, you and your colleagues have been working on a new method to fight atherosclerosis that uses nano-sized drones. Can you give us a bit of an overview about these nano drones and this new treatment method?
I think the most important thing to understand about this advance is that it represents an integration of two new concepts, each of which are very important in their own right. So the first concept is using these targeted drones, and the second concept is the drug that we loaded the drones with, which is a very special and novel type of drug. So with regard to these drones, and we call these nanoparticles because they're small spheres that are very, very small, and so we use the word nano to designate that they're extraordinarily small. And the key properties of these nanoparticles is that they tend to go to areas of the vessels in our body that have these atherosclerotic plaques that cause heart disease. So these little tiny particles have been specifically designed by my colleagues at Brigham and Women, and it's very important to acknowledge Drs. Omid Farrakhzad and Nazila Kamali, because they were the brains behind designing these little nanoparticles that have a special property to find atherosclerotic lesions, and once they get there, to stay there.
What are these nanoparticles made of?
They're manufactured, and they're made of a type of chemical that we call a polymer. And it's important to note that all of the building blocks are FDA approved, and nanoparticles very, very similar to the ones that we're using have been already approved for clinical trials in people for other diseases or other conditions such as cancer or, believe it or not, smoking cessation. So these are FDA-approved building blocks that have already gone into clinical trials in humans for other purposes.
I'm quite curious, Doctor, how do these nanodrones zero in on arterial plaque, and what do they do once they reach their target?
So there are three major properties that allow this to occur. The first property is they're coated in a way that makes it so that blood cells or other tissues in our body that would normally gobble them up and get them out of our body does not do that. And so the trick is to get these little nanoparticles to circulate in our bloodstream for as long as possible. The second property is that they are of a certain very small size and a certain charge such that they tend to go through areas of leaky blood vessels. And that is what characterizes these atherosclerotic lesions and distinguishes them from other places in our circulation, that these plaques tend to be leaky. And so these nanoparticles, because of their size and charge, tend to migrate to areas that have leaks in them. And then the third property is they were designed to have a little piece on them that recognizes something in the vessel wall. So once they leak through and get inside the vessel wall, they stick. And it's those three properties that favor their localization to these atherosclerotic plaques. So then the drones get inside the vessel wall, and then the drug that we package it with slowly leaks out of these particles. And then the drug that leaks out then can work on the various cells in the plaque, and then it promotes this healing process that is characteristic of these drugs. What we've known for a number of years now is that atherosclerosis, although initiated by the LDL or the cholesterol in our blood, after that initiation, that what drives the disease is inflammation. Now, inflammation is what all of us have to protect us against bacteria and viruses. But in the atherosclerotic lesion, this process gets out of hand. And in particular, whereas when we're fighting a bacteria or a virus, the inflammation is linked very directly to a healing process, which is meant to heal our body after the bacteria or virus are cleared, in atherosclerosis, this link is broken. So atherosclerosis has inflammation without the healing. And what these drugs do is promote the healing phase of this process.
Do you consider this treatment a cure?
It's not a cure. What it does have the potential for doing, and this is a very important niche in this field, is that we can identify people that are at very high risk for heart attacks. And we know what we can do for these people in terms of long-term prevention. But for a period of 2 to 3 to 4 years, these people are still at very, very high risk. What I think this type of therapy could do in that large population of people at very high risk is lower their risk for heart disease during this vulnerable period.
That was Dr. Ira Tabus, a professor of medicine, pathology, and cell biology at Columbia University in New York. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. So stop by and visit us on the internet. The address again is voanews.com/science. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I'm Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.